Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin. Before diving into today's topic, I am pleased to announce that today's podcast represents our 50th published interview on Research on Religion. We consider this quite an accomplishment and are excited that our listenership is increasing every week. Some of you know that we launched on July 1st of last year and may be doing a bit of math in your head under the knowledge that there are actually 52 weeks in a year and 50 episodes should put us deeper into June. Well, it turns out that we backlogged several episodes when we launched last July so that folks tuning in would already have an opportunity to browse a variety of topics. So our one-year anniversary is really late May, early June. We invite new listeners to sift through our archives to find some of our early gems, including interviews with James Felak on Pope John Paul II and communism, Steve Pfaff on the spread of the Reformation, and Eric Stanley on religious freedom. Also, there may be a few of you paying close attention who happen to notice that although we have aired 50 episodes to date, this podcast is actually labeled as our 51st MP3 file. That is because we actually conducted 51 interviews, but one of the interviews was not aired for some interesting sociological reasons. Nothing nefarious, I can't really tell you what it is, and in reality it was very interesting and enlightening interview. But we had to shelf it for reasons not necessarily related to content. And hopefully one day we might be able to air it and give a full explanation as to its delay, but for right now it adds an air of mystery to our show. And finally, don't forget to friend us on Facebook for weekly updates and to join our conversation about the topics that we have on the show. All right, let's move on to today's topic, which is secular threats to religion in the United States. And to discuss this with me, I am deeply honored to be joined by William Donahue, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights, based in New York City. Bill has authored several books, including Twilight of Liberty, The Legacy of the ACLU, The New Freedom, Individualism and Collectivism in the Social Lives of Americans, and, most recently, Secular Sabotage, How Liberals Are Destroying Religion and Culture in America, which will be the topic of our discussion today. Bill is by far our most prominent and recognizable guest to date, having appeared regularly on such television networks as CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. He's even debated Lady Gaga, I think. We might hear a little bit about that a little bit later. Bill, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be on with you, Tony.
Well, great. I should also note that in addition to your rather extensive resume, you hold a PhD in sociology from NYU. And so you're not just a willy-nilly pundit that uses words carelessly, but you are actually trained to use words. Is that correct?
Well, that's true. I'm very proud of my scholarship there. I spent a tour in the Air Force during the Vietnam War period and came back and finished 3 years of college and 2 years at NYU. Then I went for my master's at the New School for Social Research, a European grounded institute of graduate studies here in New York City, and then back to NYU for my PhD, which was awarded in 1980 from NYU. I spent 20 years in education, 4 working with little kids in Spanish Harlem, and 16 as a professor. I have taught every grade from the second grade right on through the graduate programs at NYU and newly minted PhDs from third world nations. So I've been around the block on this issue, I tell you, I regret people when I hear that they're not happy with their jobs, because that must be a terrible way to live. I've been very, very fortunate. I've always loved my work.
Yeah, I have to admit that I do too. Academia is a place that allows you a great deal of freedom to explore the interests that you want, and one of the results of that is this podcast. And so I'm having a great time too. So we should have a great time today. Let's get on to your book here. And the title of your book that we are discussing today is called "Secular Sabotage: How Liberals Are Destroying Religion and Culture in America." However, when you start reading this book, the title seems to be a bit misleading in the first few pages, in that the first chapter
And you set out the parameters of the conflict that you're talking about between the religious, primarily Christians, and a certain category of the cultural left that you term nihilists. I want to know, who are these nihilists? How do they differ from liberals, if they do at all? And why are they the ones most engaged in this secular sabotage, as you call it?
Well, that's an excellent question. Let me begin by saying this. When I'm talking about the left, I'm talking about these people who believe that we have the tools as human beings to create the good society on Earth, independent of any help from the transcendent. We can simply have the reins of government, take control, and remake society, because human nature is basically like a piece of putty that can be changed and molded at will. Now, I come from a Catholic school of thought which believes that there is such a thing as fixed human nature, that it's ordained by God, and that while we can make improvements here on Earth, there is such a thing as sin. Now, having said that, the left, if you go back into the 19th century, and we're not going back too far in history, and I'm thinking here in terms of the Marxist, they believed that they had a blueprint to reform society. I think it was an inherently flawed prescription, but at least they had an idea that if you tore down the capitalist system and you replaced it with a socialist model, you would eventually prepare the way for communism and it would be the good society. Now, it never worked out quite that way. The reason it didn't is because they never understood human nature. Having said that, we saw what happened in the 20th century, didn't we, when the application of Marxist thought came to fruition in 1917 in the Russian Revolution. They left anywhere upwards of 63 million people dead under the Soviets, as estimated by Alexander Solzhenitsyn. They've murdered about 77 million men, women, and children under Mao Zedong in communist China. They killed about a third of all the people in Cambodia under the name of communism. So that always has failed. Now, how are they different from what I call the nihilist today? Well, whatever we might say about the Marxist, they had good intentions. They wanted to make the society better. They just had a flawed idea because their picture of God and man was inherently flawed to begin with. And if you get the anthropology and the theology wrong, you get everything wrong.
Right.
Today's people on the left are nihilists. In other words, they don't have any blueprint for change. They don't have nirvana. They're not saying, if you follow us, we'll make society better. They're just angry at what they see. They've tried socialism. It's spent. It didn't work. Now what they want to do is to tear down the cultural edifice of society. Unlike the Marxists who wanted to jimmy the economy, these are more the cultural Marxists like Gramsci out of Italy in the 19th century, who said if we get a hold of the means of communication, that's how you really change society with ideas and values. And what we want to do is to destroy what we see in Western civilization. And they've done a pretty good job of trying to accomplish their aims.
Is there some kind of understanding that if we just tear down the cultural edifice as it exists today, and they don't have a plan for replacing it with anything, but they have this idea that a more perfect human nature will just flourish from this chaos?
Well, I think that was certainly true in the past. There's no question. You certainly have some contemporary people on the left who do believe that they have this kind of Pollyannish, naive view of human nature, and once we take command, we can reshape human nature. There's still that's still out there. But what's happened increasingly is there's this sense of frustration and exasperation on the part of the people on the left. They're almost like brats who just want to take the guitar and smash it. They don't really have anything to, you know, if you want to take something apart, that's one thing, as long as you can build something better than what you had previously. But if all you want to do is tear down, because you have nothing, you're intellectually spent, you're intellectually exhausted, you have nothing there to put in its place, then it seems to me these people, to that extent, are as dangerous, perhaps even more dangerous, than the pedigree of where they came from. They have to be resisted if you want to live in a free society.
Now, where have these folks developed from? I mean, has this been an increasing trend? Is there a certain pattern in our history where these folks really have reared their head and have increased? Are they on the rise or are they on the decrease? What's your sense historically of this?
Well, I think they have been on the rise. There's no question about it. And I would say that you can mark the more recent changes from what was called the second thoughts movement into our society. Let me be explicit here. Back in the 1960s, the New Left, they believed that we could support the communists in Cambodia, support the communists in Vietnam, support the communists in China, in North Korea, the Soviet Union, Cuba, and everything would be better. Now, after we left Vietnam, what happened is that the communists came in and they did what they always do. They plundered and they murdered and they pillaged the people and they oppressed them. Now, there were some people on the left, not the Jane Fondas, but the people who mattered, people like David Horowitz, for example. He calls himself a red diaper baby. David Horowitz is originally from New York City, a Jewish fellow whose parents were members of the Communist Party, hence the idea of the red diaper baby. He was raised as a far leftist and as a communist, and he, along with another fellow, put out a publication called Ramparts, which was the flagship radical publication in the 60s and the early 70s. Now, once we left Vietnam and they saw what happened with the atrocities by the communists, people like Horowitz were at least intellectually honest. They were shaken. They couldn't believe what was happening. And they began to think, was I wrong de novo from the beginning? And they had this reexamination, this examination of conscience, so to speak, and they realized that they've been had. And so what they've made the turn now, and they're trying to make our society better from what would be considered today a more of a conservative position. However, they are regarded as heretical. They are regarded as the enemy by those people who didn't have this epiphany, who still believe that if the best way to proceed is to tear down what we have, because it's true that communism doesn't work. They understand that. But they're not happy with what they see in Western society. They don't like a lot of the materialism, which a lot of people can object to for a lot of healthy reasons. But they don't like the market economy. They want to be in control, but they even know that that doesn't work. So they resort to kind of thrashing our institutions. And if you really wanted to take down a society culturally, people like Gramsci, again, from Italy, that's how they wanted to move. If you want to tear down a society culturally, you have no other choice than to go to the heart of any culture, which, of course, has always been religion. That's exactly what they're doing. They know that the Judeo-Christian ethos is what's undergirded our society and the Western civilization. And if they figure they can rip at that and tear at that edifice, they'll have made some inroads. They're not wrong, by the way. I agree with them that these people are out to sabotage. They are radical, militant secularists. And can I just make one point here very clear to the listeners?
Yeah, no problem.
I am not talking about people who might be an atheist or an agnostic. Most of these people are good human beings like anybody else. They go about their life. There's an atheist in New York City who has given approximately $30 million to the Archdiocese of New York. Now, why would an atheist give $30 million to the Archdiocese of New York? Because he believes in Catholic education. He believes in Catholic schools, particularly in the inner city. He says, yes, I am not an atheist, but you know, I understand the good work that the Catholic Church does. I have met a lot of people, I'm not going to mention them on the air, but they were very famous people who have told me off the air, because I've done so many different TV programs over the years, people have told me, you know, Bill, I wish I could believe. I'm not hostile to religion. In fact, I envy you. It just hasn't happened. And I would tell this person, maybe it'll happen. These things take time. So these people are not a problem. I'm talking about the militant, dogmatic atheists, the people who are the activists, who are radical, who want to turn our society upside down and inside out. I don't have to read into what they want. If people read what they say, they're very honest and very clear about what they want. You're not going to get the path to the good society that way, which is why people like myself and others resist. But that's what's driving this.
Yeah, let's give an example of this secular sabotage. And one came up recently. We're recording this on April 21st, and you were just in the news yesterday, I believe, with something known as the Lady Gaga controversy. Tell us what that is all about, because I think it illustrates really what you're talking about here.
Yes, and it is amazing. Listeners will appreciate this, how the media work. They often ask me, say, why do you get upset about Lady Gaga? Are you not giving her more attention? To which I have to say, well, you're the one who called me. I didn't put out a statement. Believe me, on a scale of 1 to 10, Lady Gaga is closer to zero. Nonetheless, I mean, I'm asked by the media. Next thing you know, I'm on the Fox News Network the other day. It's picked up in Russia on the front page of Pravda a week ago today on their website. We do live in a celebrity-crazy world, not just the United States. In any event, what's the problem with Lady Gaga? Well, problem with Lady Gaga, like the Madonna wannabe she wants to be, these are, you know, ex-Catholic girls, went to Catholic schools, they have a problem with religion, and they have to tweak our sensibilities. Now, Madonna was probably arguably worse. Lady Gaga now puts out gives us an Easter gift. The timing is what matters. She comes out here now Easter weekend with Judas is her song. I love Judas. Okay, fine. And here we go again down this road. She's played a nun in rather an obscene way, which I'm not going to discuss here, the particulars. She's shown herself swallowing rosaries and whatnot. Like Sinead O'Connor and Madonna, these are gals who have to work something out. And while they're working it out, I think they could just get their hands off our religion. And, of course, it's always our religion that they seek to thrash. It's never Islam. And I think there's a good reason for that.
Well, let's hold off on that for a minute, because I want to talk about something that you mentioned earlier about living in a free society. Americans pride themselves on living in a very free nation. And along with that freedom comes the ability to basically do anything. Now, on page 7 of your book, you write something that I think is really interesting, and I want you to explore this a little bit more. You write here, quote, "The American experiment was never supposed to be a celebration of unbridled liberty," unquote. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that the founders understood human nature correctly, and they understood, as Edmund Burke and understood and others who have affected the thinking of the founding fathers, that freedom, in order to exist, has to be limited. Now, that may sound contradictory, but it's not. Just think of it this way. If I'm free to do whatever I want to do, then I'm going to debilitate your rights, because at some point I may just want to, you know, race my car right through the streets, and I may regard stop signs and stoplights as an infringement on my liberty. If I want to just go on the basis of my impulses and my appetites, then I will go about willy-nilly trying to satisfy them independent of what happens to you. I may, in fact, want to inject my AIDS, which I've gotten from some kind of morally reckless encounters, onto innocent and suspecting persons, and then take a kind of a sociopathic so what attitude. I mean, in order to have freedom, you have to understand it has to be limited. There's no such thing as absolute liberty. The founders understood this. Just take freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they passed the sedition laws, didn't they? I mean, freedom, this is the problem with our society today. Freedom and things like freedom of speech, which are at the heart of liberty, freedom of speech is not an end. Freedom of speech is a means to an end. What is the end? The good society, as described in the preamble to the Constitution of the United States. If you just are so hung up on the individual right to exercise whatever I want, and you don't exercise any type of limits, and you don't put restraints on your own behavior, you're going to collide into the rights of innocent human beings. So what our society is about today, unfortunately, is that we have a radically individualistic society, not just in the United States. It's true in Canada, and it's throughout Western Europe. It's an idea of the exalted individual, the unbridled self, that I have the right to do whatever I want to do. And you know, quite frankly, unless people are inculcated with moral virtues of prudence and tolerance and restraint, they will, in fact, follow their appetites. That doesn't lead to freedom. That leads to moral anarchy. And when you get to that stage, then people will demand that the government come in. If you want despotism, then what you should do is to have unbridled liberty. And people might say, well, wait a minute, unbridled liberty is the opposite of despotism. Not in the real world it isn't, because when people are free to do exactly what they want to do, they won't respect their neighbors, they won't respect property, they won't respect other people's rights, they'll become self-indulgent to an extreme. And in that kind of society, it begins to become atomistic, it begins to dissolve itself, and then people will demand that the government come in there and instill order. That's the problem when you take freedom and you take it to extremes.
It's an interesting problem that I think we have here in the United States as well, because we're a country of immigrants, we're a country of different cultures that come from all over the world. And when we talk about inculcating moral virtues and ideas that can control our appetites, we run into this problem of whose virtues or whose morals do we need to address here? And in many ways, that leads us to this culture of multiculturalism that we have, and somewhere leads down the path of relativism. And you saw this as one of the big threats to religiosity here in America as well in one of your chapters. Tell us a little bit about multiculturalism.
Well, multiculturalism in the best possible way would mean that we come to respect other cultures and that we don't try to judge them strictly through our own prism of our own standards, and that we understand that diversity and pluralism is a good thing, and that we treat people fairly, even if they differ from us in different manners and in terms of their folk ways and their moral ways. I mean, that's okay up to a point. Now, why did I say up to a point? I'll tell you why. Because I'm not going to have any respect for a society which abuses women in ways that is too vulgar to discuss it on the phone that are done in many third world nations.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to have any respect for a nation which has no respect for human rights whatsoever. I'm not going to respect a nation where if you convert from one religion to another, that they can legally kill you. I think those kinds of cultures are a disgrace. I think they need to be overthrown if you believe in freedom. Now, what's happened, multiculturalism, the way it's become interpreted, is really been used as a club to beat down the only culture which has ever given us any degree of freedom and equality in the history of the world. I'm talking about the Judeo-Christian culture anchored in Western civilization, which is responsible for the freedoms that we have. It didn't come from the East. The ideas of individual liberty and equality before law and due process did not emanate from China or Japan. They didn't even have a word for freedom until more recently in these parts of the world. It didn't come from Africa. It didn't come from the Middle East. It came mostly from the result of Christianity, the contributions of the Catholic Church, many of those the visions that were rooted in Judaism and then distilled under Christianity. So when you begin to attack, as the secular saboteurs do, the Judeo-Christian ethos, our culture, our values, our normative system, what are you going to replace it with? I mean, despite our flaws, and God knows there are flaws, despite our flaws, if we're the best that money can buy. I mean, let's face it, one of the major problems the United States has today is trying to keep all the people from around the world who want to come in. Most parts of the world throughout history have never had a problem like that. They've had a problem keeping the people who are in who want to get out. That's the difference between us and the others. And to the extent that people denigrate Western society, and they do it and they thrash it in the history books, the social science textbooks, in the elementary and in the secondary schools. I mean, it's one thing to be have fair-minded criticism of American history or Western civilization. That's all good. I'm in favor of that. But when you become hypercritical, when you compare the way we are to some idea which never existed except on the blackboard of a professor, and you don't compare Western civilization to everything else that we've known throughout the history of the world, which couldn't even match the successes that we've had, morally, scientifically, ethically, in every other way, then I have to say there's something seriously wrong.
Yeah, there's an interesting paradox that you brought up in talking about this, especially when you talk about the moral nihilist who want to tear down primarily Judeo-Christian culture and are strongly attacking the Catholic Church and evangelical Protestant denominations. and such is that they don't have much to replace it with, and their focus on just tearing down the dominant culture at the time paints them into a box in some regards, because then they favor other cultures. They say, well, you know, we really need to give proper due respect to this certain culture and their moral attitudes and such. They're on an equivalent basis as Christianity. Yet some of the virtues that they have would be, you know, stoning homosexuals to death or genital mutilation of women and other things like that, that those same people actually abhor as well. So it's very difficult to square that circle, I think.
Boy, you're spot on. You absolutely very elegantly discussed the paradox. And they're in a jam, and there's no way out. You gave the examples of we're supposed to respect other countries. Sure. Are we going to respect that in the Middle East and in Muslim-run nations that they'll take homosexuals and throw them off the roof of a building with impunity? Are we going to clitorectomies in Muslim-run nations? We've had instances in the United States not too long ago. People from other parts of the world, in this case here, the man was from Cambodia. He contested with his lawyer in the court being prosecuted for beating his wife. He said, listen, from where I come from, wife beating is acceptable. Who are you to impose your values on me? And you know what? If you've been drinking too much from the well of multiculturalism, of moral relativism, you don't really have an answer, do you?
Yeah.
How dare we impose our values on this man who wants to beat his wife? Whoever said that wife beating should be wrong? Isn't that the imposition of values on somebody else? Shouldn't we have different strokes for different folks? Shouldn't we have cultural respect for what they're doing? Now, I have no problem with it because I believe in natural law. I believe in natural rights. And I also believe in the Constitution of the United States, because I live in the United States and proud to be an American, and I understand that, no, you're not allowed to do what you want, because we have something, for example, called the 13th Amendment to the Constitution, passed in 1865, which says that you are not allowed to own a black person. They don't say it in those words, but that's what it is. We have an abolition against slavery. People who think that slavery is fine have no right to be in the United States. They should go someplace else, because slavery is against the law. That kind of freedom, the freedom to own a slave and the freedom of the master to impose his will on his servant, is not something that we're going to accept in the United States. We understand that in order to have freedom, you have to have limits. And there's a perfect example. The limits have to be when you begin to decimate the rights of innocent others.
Mm-hmm. And as you've mentioned, and this, you make this very clear in your book, Secular Sabotage, that the primary target of these cultural nihilists tends to be Christianity writ large and Catholicism in specific. They really seem to hate the Catholic Church. I want to just run through a few examples that you have in your book here. Tell us a little bit about the art world. And when I talk about art, I'm talking what you typically think of, painting and sculpture. I'm going to get to Hollywood here in a second. But how have artists really gone after the Catholic Church in specific?
Well, you know, it just to a large extent, I mean, anybody who appreciates art is going to understand that it was expected to be the quest for beauty, and sometimes that becomes denigrated itself. And we certainly, anybody who respects the rights of artists understands that they have to have some liberties. Mm-hmm. We understand that. But just as I've said before, that in order for freedom to exist, it has to be limited. Otherwise, you won't have it. It'll turn into moral anarchy. The artists have to understand that they have a certain degree of responsibility, if not to their patrons, then certainly to the citizens in the United States. And when you have people who trash other people, who intentionally seek to assault their religious sensibilities under the name art, I mean, if that's what art is, that you can just simply slap the name as a template on any kind of wanton destruction of other people's sensibilities, then I don't think that the artistic community is ennobled by doing that. And that's what we've seen one example after another over the last century, a half century in particular, in the Western world. I mean, I was asked about this one time by a woman who was a critic, she happened to be Jewish, of my criticism of Andre Serrano, who would take a crucifix and dunk it into a jar of his own urine. And she said that I shouldn't protest because I missed the point. He was just simply making a statement about how Christians were not acting like good Christians. To which I said, then you wouldn't object if I took the Star of David and put it into a bowl of feces, and then when you got upset, I would just instruct you that Jews should start being more like Abraham. She didn't understand the analogy. She was furious and started yelling at me. And you see, this goes on all the time. There's a tremendous amount of hypocrisy. You have ants running all over a crucifix in the Smithsonian last Thanksgiving and Christmas. It didn't last except for a few hours before I objected and got the help of some people in Washington. Never asked them to pull it, by the way. Never asked them to censor it. Never asked the government to come in there and take it away. What I did do is this. I said, you have this picture of a video of Jesus on the cross with large ants crawling all over his body, and you're doing it in a venue which is supported by the taxpayers to the tune of 70 cents on every dollar is supported by the taxpayers, 80% of whom are Christians. So I raised the point. If it's wrong to take the taxpayers' money to fund and to promote religion, why is it acceptable for that same government to take the taxpayer money and then insult religion? Well, they did pull the offensive art there, and then I raised the point. I said, well, if you think that this is basically innocuous and I'm overreacting, then will you choose Martin Luther King on a cross with the large ants running across his body during Black History Month in February? Will you choose Ramadan and put a depiction of Muhammad there with the ants? And, of course, they got the point, but they still stuck to their guns that when it comes to us, somehow it's art. I don't appreciate intellectual dishonesty. I've had many debates with Christopher Hitchens over the year, and while I think that his comments and things that he said about Christianity and Catholicism in particular are vile and malicious, you will never hear me criticize him for being intellectually dishonest. He will tell you right to your face, I don't like your religion, they don't like any religions, and I'm out to thrash them. At least I can deal with him at that level.
Yeah. It's interesting what you say, too, about the freedom of expression. It's not necessarily that you, at the Catholic League, have been trying to censor expression in somewhat of a prudish manner in that regard, but it's the issue of taxpayer funding of a lot of this, because once you start funding a lot of these works in terms of dollars that the taxpayers send off to Washington, D.C. every year, you mentioned that issue where, well, we're trying to separate church and state, so why are we funding then people who are very malicious toward church and state? But also, it takes away some of the freedom of other individuals as well when I'm forced to use my tax dollars to fund something that I highly disagree with.
Well, just consider this. We have a situation where in the rotunda of the state capitol in Pennsylvania, in Harrisburg, a number of years ago, they asked senior citizens to make Christmas ornaments. An ACLU lawyer went over on his lunch break, and he noticed that a number of them were in the form of a cross. He objected. He went into federal district court, and it was thrown out, but he objected. Now, my point is this. If you can't have a cross without it being contested, made up by senior citizens put up on a Christmas tree in a state capitol, if that's objectionable to the secularist, are you telling me now that these same people would find it acceptable, which they would, if you took that exact same cross and dunked it into a jar of urine? Now all of a sudden it becomes art, and I'm expected not only to accept it, but to pay for it. See, that's what I'm saying about the intellectual dishonesty. When the Catholic League raised its First Amendment right to freedom of speech, saying that this was wrong to do this on the taxpayer's dime with the ants running all over Jesus on the cross, we didn't ask the government to come in there and stop the exhibition. Quite unlike what happened here about a month ago in New York City, when there was a huge poster on the side of a building of a young black girl, and it said something to the effect, the most dangerous place for a black person to be is in the womb. It was made up mostly by black pro-life people who were very concerned about the high rate of abortion, particularly in the black community. Now, people were free to agree with it or to disagree with it. What did they do in New York City? The government, the state. Talk about separation of church and state. The Speaker of the City Council, Christine Quinn, along with the public advocate, Bill de Blasio, and others, objected, and they said, tear this down. Get that thing off the building. Now, there's a case of real, true censorship. The government coming in there and saying, we're offended by this speech, it has to go. They were never criticized. Not one peep of criticism against true government censorship by the same people who criticized me for objecting my First Amendment right to freedom of speech about the Smithsonian exhibition and never asked the government to come in there and solve my problem for me. And that kind of hypocrisy is really what drives what us here at the Catholic League. All we want is a level playing field. Treat us the same way you do everybody else, and we'll close up our doors.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about Hollywood right now, and you wrote an interesting chapter on this, and you were involved in a number of controversies surrounding a couple of movies. On one side, the more nihilistic movies, as you would call them, Priest and Dogma, and then on the other hand, a very pro-religious movie, The Passion of the Christ. Tell us a little bit about your involvement in those controversies, and how that, in many ways, illustrates what you're talking about here in terms of secular sabotage.
Well, in terms of the movie Priest, it came out in 1995, and what bothered me about it were several things. I was only in the job about 2 years. I learned about this movie. What did I learn about it? Well, it was about five priests, all of whom were dysfunctional. Not a single normal, healthy, sane priest responsible. Every one of them decrepit. And not only were they irresponsible, but their dysfunctionality was a function of their priesthood. In other words, it's because they were priests that they were dysfunctional. They were alcoholics, they were lechers, predators, and the like. And I thought, wait a minute, if you want to have a movie and you happen to have a bad priest in the movie, I'm not going to complain. There are, in fact, bad priests. But if every priest that the audience meet happens to be morally a slug, and if, in fact, what drives him to be such a slug is his vocation, then you're setting up a fight. That was one element I didn't like. Then I found out that the movie house putting it out was Miramax, which at that time was owned by Disney. I said, Disney? Snow White, Disney, Mickey Mouse, Disney is now in the business of promoting a movie which is in a direct assault on Catholics. And the third leg of outrage was when I found out that in 1995 they planned the opening day on, you got it, Good Friday. Here's what happened. I held a press conference over at the Archdiocese in New York. Unbeknownst, all these people from Disney and Miramax came in and tried to sell this as a joint press conference. I threw them out of the Archdiocese, told them to get their hats and coats and get out, that they're not going to hijack my situation. The press turned on them, and they agreed that they would not open on Good Friday. Of course, they stuck to their guns on the movie. We waged war against a culture war against Disney, and eventually we succeeded in getting Disney and Miramax to get divorced. They're no longer there, joined at the hip. So that expressed my anger there. In the case of Dogma, well, it was Playboy magazine which first came out and said, wait till Bill Donahue at the Catholic League gets wind of this one. Kevin Smith is out there intentionally trying to thrash Catholics. And I thought, well, if I'm being baited by the secularist, I'm not going to ignore it and pretend it doesn't exist. And so we put out a booklet detailing the problems that we had with that movie. Now, there's a lot of examples of movies that we've had problems with over the years. And we've looked in vain. I mean, when would Hollywood finally put out a movie that would endear themselves to Christians that we could be proud of, like we were at the movies back in long before my time? And I guess the last movie that I remember that went over big, that was loved by audiences all over the world, was The Sound of Music. And then what we saw in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and up until recently is the thrashing of Christianity. Mel Gibson comes along and he offers us a movie which was absolutely gripping, which was an account that most Christians were incredibly moved by the Passion of the Christ. Nobody in Hollywood wanted to touch it with a 10-foot pole. I wound up on television long before the movie had come out, discussing the controversy about it and debating it with people, with others who had, were already critical without having seen it. And to make a very long story short, Mel happened to catch me on TV, gave me a call up, called the next day, said we got to meet, and that's how it started. And I became friends with Mel and defended his movie as I always will.
It's kind of interesting about that movie that you were on television defending this movie and people were on television critiquing the movie even before it came out, even before most people had seen the movie, which I think really emphasizes your point that in Secular Sabotage, that it's not so much the actual content of what is going on that people are critiquing, but it's just the whole concept of this is going to be a pro-Christian or pro-Catholic movie.
Well, that's just it. It's you know, it's just like this morning, I'm putting out news releases about the depictions of nuns on Broadway. I mean, you had Kathleen Turner playing some foul-mouthed nun, former alcoholic. Now, the good news is it only lasts 10 days and it's gone. It opened up last week. It's gone. It's been gone in a couple of days. So I'm happy with that. But then Sister Act is on Broadway. Listen, we don't have a problem with Sister Act. Catholics have a problem with Sister Act. Need to get their head examined. We're not above having some fun, some good humor, Mel Brooks type of humor, make a little fun of us, a little fun of everybody else. As long as it's not vulgar and denigrating and dehumanizing, I have no problem with something like Sister Act. So why did I object? I didn't object to the play. I objected to the way the New York Times characterized it, saying that the play was kind of shallow. It had about as much substance as a communion wafer. It had about as much depth as a communion wafer, maybe with a little less bite. So my point is that even when you have a movie or a play which is not offensive, such as Sister Act, that doesn't mean that somebody out there who wants to sucker punch and dig and put a little smack against Christians isn't going to come out there and make his little contribution trying to, ridicule the Eucharist. And, you know, they know that the Eucharist is the heart and soul of Catholicism, which is precisely why they made that kind of comment in the New York Times.
Yeah. One of the interesting things that, for me at least, in terms of Hollywood, is that Hollywood is always said to be interested in the bottom line. They want to bring a lot of people into the box office. That's why we see so many sequels of Spider-Man 2 and Spider-Man 3 during the season, summer movie season. It's successful once, let's give it a go again. Nonetheless, there are a lot of these movies like Priest and Dogma that really flop. But on the other hand, you see a movie like The Passion of the Christ, which is, I think, the highest grossing film of all time. And other ones like The Blind Side, these rarely get made, even though they're very popular with middle America, the 80% of regular Christians here in the United States that just love these films. Why doesn't Hollywood make more of these? Why do they keep insisting on giving us Dogma and Priest and the things on Broadway about
nuns? Michael Medved is an Orthodox Jewish friend of mine. He's probably one of the most astute observers of Hollywood in the United States. He's a filmmaker, he's an author, the TV commentator, he's written books on Hollywood, and he's looked at this question. And he freely admits that Hollywood is stridently anti-Christian, particularly anti-Catholic. And he's raised that question. How come, if it's profitable to make, let's say, G-rated movies over R-rated movies, why don't we see more of them? And his answer basically is this, that money is overrated as a motivator. You take, for example, the example of the movie Priest, okay? You've got Disney Miramax. Well, Miramax at that time wasn't a huge operation. It's separate now. Harvey Weinstein is back out there with the King's Speech, and he's doing well again today with other kinds of fare. But my point is this, that when Miramax wasn't a huge operation, why did they put it out? Well, because Disney was funding it, basically. Disney was the parent organization. They were making their money off of the wholesome Snow White image, but it just goes to show you that if you have enough bucks, you can always play your ideological card, and that's what has to be understood here by readers and by listeners. is that there are people in our society who are so possessed by an idea that they've got to get it out there one way or another, and they are willing to take a hit, not all the time, but they're willing to take an occasional hit at the box office in order to make their cultural and political statement. It's tragic. It's unfortunate. It's usually done at the expense of other people's rights. But it just goes to show that money doesn't control everything.
There's a few other parts of your book where you go after the ACLU and political parties, namely the Democratic Party. I'm going to leave that for our listeners to pick up your book and read that, because I think those are really interesting chapters. But unfortunately, we don't have that much time. The two chapters that really piqued my attention in the book come near the end of Secular Sabotage. And you talk about the self-sabotaging tendency within Catholicism and within Protestantism itself, that it's not just external nihilists that are causing some of these problems in the culture war, the Lady Gaga's, the people who make Dogma, and the people, you know, Serrano and such. But there's also problems within the institutions of Christianity as well. So what if you could give us a little bit of sense of how the Catholic Church is, as you say, self-sabotaging itself?
Yes, and this is a phenomena which grew out of the 1960s. There's no question about it. You know, the heyday of American Catholicism in the United States, without doubt, every historian agrees, was the 1950s. I mean, stronger than the 1950s than anything we saw before that time, certainly in the 19th century. It was the heyday of American Catholicism. Our culture changed, in some respects for the better, in some respects for the worse. In the 1960s, we went through a cultural revolution. On the plus side, African Americans were awarded their political rights, which were long denied them, and as well as other segments of American population. On the downside, we had this assault on traditional values, which continues to this day, the kind of nihilistic examples that we've been talking about. Now, in the Catholic Church, they had Vatican II between 1962 and 1965, made a number of reforms to make the church a bit more modern. Many of those reforms were well thought out and very good. However, when implemented, not actually on paper, but when implemented, a number of people here in the United States, and indeed throughout the West in particular, took those ideas and ran with them. In other words, instead of making gentle reforms, it turned into a gallop. What happened is that there was a quick move to become more secular. Now, that led to a number of people leaving the priesthood and the sisterhood. They said that we had become too secular, and so it wasn't good for us. We're going to leave. We can understand that. That happens in different vocations and professions. But not everybody left. Who stayed were a number of people who believed that we want to change the Catholic Church roughly into more like what the mainline Protestant denominations have become. We're too restrictive on matters sexual. We should take a more progressive and liberal attitude toward contraception, toward abortion. We should open up the church to women. We should allow priests to marry. We shouldn't be talking about restrictions on sexual activity. We should take a more pro-gay position within the Catholic Church. We should talk less about sin and evil and more about happy type of sugar and spice and everything nice kinds of ideas. And essentially, they had a real problem with the way the Catholic Church had been, but they believed that they could change it. The Vatican II gave them the engine to make the reforms they wanted. They mistook Vatican II. Vatican II wanted to make some changes, but not glacial changes of the like that they're talking about. They stayed on, and instead of leaving like some of the others did, they became increasingly angry, alienated, and they are the ones within the Catholic Church who have been trying stridently to change the Catholic Church, to turn it into something which it doesn't want to be, it wasn't supposed to be, and instead of doing the honest thing and leaving, they stay, they park themselves where the power is, because once you're let's say you're an alienated pro-abortion nun, and there's no end to the pro-abortion nuns. If anybody have any doubts about it, it's called the National Coalition of American Nuns. They are pro-abortion, and they are organized. Okay, so I'm talking about just a few people, a few crackpots. We're talking about large swath of them. Not all nuns, that's for damn sure, but we certainly a number of them. And what these people want is to change the Catholic Church on everything on sexuality so that the church's teachings mirror the editorial position of the New York Times and NPR and PBS. They're unhappy and they're angry and they're ordaining women, so to speak, on their boats because, this is beyond bizarre that people, I could go around, I guess I'd call myself Pope Bill, but if I kept it up, maybe somebody might put me in the asylum with the others who think that they're bishops and cardinals. Here we have grown women walking the streets of America thinking that they're priests because they were ordained over a cocktail party in somebody's home. These people have become delirious, and they are, quite frankly, become the biggest enemies of the Catholic Church. They're sitting right inside the Catholic Church. Many of them work in Catholic institutions, and I'm very specific as to who I'm talking about in that chapter.
You liken this as well to the decline of mainline Protestantism as well, which you see in Catholicism, that the mainline Protestant churches, you know, going back to, you know, the early 1600s, you had the Puritans, but they eventually became the United Church of Christ, and their membership is dwindling quite rapidly in recent years, is that they've really lost their rigorous spiritual soul, so to speak, and as you mentioned, try to become more secularized. So you see some, do you see some similarities between mainline Protestantism engaging in the self-sabotage as well as
Protestants have just simply been faster than Catholics. The Protestants, unfortunately, don't have a catechism, they don't have a pope, and so therefore it's much more of a free-for-all. It's interesting, all the people in the Catholic Church who are unhappy with the Catholic Church who wanted to take it more progressive, well, the Episcopalians, for example, and the Presbyterians and the Methodists, and the Evangelical Lutheran Church and others, they've already given these Catholics what they want. So if the answer to the Catholic Church is to become more like the mainline Protestants, how come the Catholic Church is inching forward with numbers, albeit mostly because of immigration? I'll grant that point. But why is it the mainline Protestant Church isn't booming? After all, they're pro-abortion, pro-gay marriage, pro-woman clergy, right down the line. The positions of the mainline Protestant churches today are almost indistinguishable from that of the editorial position of the New York Times. Why aren't they booming? In fact, they are declining. The death of Protestantism has been written about in books and articles, and not sarcastically. It's happening. What's happening to the Episcopal Church, to the Presbyterians, the Methodists, the Lutherans, is an incredible story in American history. Because when you begin to stand for nothing, when your teachings bleed into that of the dominant culture, when there's nothing to distinguish yourself, why bother to get up on a Sunday morning and to go to a service to hear the exact same teachings that could be gained by sitting in your own home, having a cup of coffee, reading the New York Times?
And I think that's a very good point. But I want on the other hand, and I want to leave off our podcast here on perhaps an optimistic note. I mean, we've been talking a lot about very dramatic attacks on Catholicism and Protestantism. And do you think that there's any sense of hyperbole going on in these culture wars that might be scaring people into thinking that we're in the end times in some respect? And the reason I say that is because the flip side of this coin is that you hear a lot of this throughout history. I mean, if you go back to the middle 1600s, you had Puritans complaining about the virtuous downfall of the colonies in America at the time. Just prior to the Great Awakening in the mid-1700s, you see the same thing. And in the late 1800s, before the fundamentalist revival, you see the same thing. But what I've also noticed, and we talked to Mark Driscoll about this in an earlier podcast, he runs a rather a theologically conservative church in the heart of darkness here in Seattle, where there's not that many religious folks. And he's been able to attract people all over the place. He just recently put in a church outside of the University of Washington campus that used to be a Baptist church that nobody was attending, and now he's got 800 people coming. And it seems to me that despite the fact that Catholicism and Protestantism have been under an assault over the past several decades, that Catholics and Protestants have really, in many ways, rallied to the challenge and have fought back from this, and in many ways have possibly strengthened it. And do you see the possibility of a new Great Awakening, that religious folks are saying, hey, we've had enough of this, we really need to go back to the basics of our faith and fundamentals and really put these forth out there in our culture and perhaps win people over?
Oh, I think that's absolutely true, and I don't want to sound apocalyptic about it. Matter of fact, I think I end secular sabotage with making the notation that people of more traditional values continue to get married and continue to have children. It's the people who entertain the free-for-all, libertine, I am the center of the world kind of idea, hostile to the Judeo-Christian ethos, who are not having children. That's because they're too busy aborting them. So, if anything, the clock of the demographic clock of history tends to be on our side. And if I didn't believe that this culture war could be won by people of a more traditional stripe, I couldn't get up in the morning to go to work. I would just simply become a bartender or drive a bus or something. No, I'm in it for the long haul, and I do think the culture war is up for grabs. You have very determined people of more traditional stripe, evangelical Protestants, traditional Catholics, and Orthodox Jews, to give you one group. And then you have people of a more militant stripe on the far left, the nihilists, the secular saboteurs. Somebody's going to win on this thing at the end of the day. And I do think that the culture is up for grabs. And there's no question. I see a lot of healthy signs. Let me give you an example within the Catholic religion. Those dioceses and those orders of nuns and priests, which are the most orthodox, most traditional, are not having a hard time getting new recruits. Guess who's dying? Guess who can't get any new recruits? Those very dioceses and those orders of priests and nuns, which have become the most secular in terms of their sentiments, their beliefs, and their practices. Well, just think of it. Why would any young girl, for example, want to give up the joys of motherhood to become a nun if, in fact, her lifestyle will be almost indistinguishable from that of a social worker? So quite frankly, the trajectory and the vector of change does suggest that the more traditional, grounded and orthodox the religion, the better they're going to be. Evangelicals are growing, not the Presbyterians and the Methodists, the Lutherans, and the Episcopals. No, the Southern Baptists are doing well, not the American Baptists. The Orthodox Jews are doing much better than the Conservative and the Reformed Jews. So the point is very, very clear. Those people who take their religion seriously are not the ones who are in fear of being decimated. To that extent, I'm optimistic in the long run. Short term, it's a battle.
Yeah. As it probably always has been throughout history.
Well, it's a struggle, but let's not forget, though. I mean, societies go on, but civilizations don't, all right? I mean, the Roman Empire collapsed partly because of moral decadence. That doesn't mean that the world ended, but was it a better place? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think so.
Well, Bill, you've given us a lot to think about here today on Research on Religion, and we really appreciate your thoughts and sentiments. And again, we urge people to sign up on Facebook to friend us and join in the conversation. So, Bill, again, thank you very much for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you so much, Tony. It's been a pleasure to be on with you. You certainly know your stuff inside and out.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.